Hey there, welcome to SaaS Unbound Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Nadina, Head of Growth at SaaS Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful SaaS businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business success. So today with me is Chris, founder of Body Swaps, a soft skill immersive VR training platform. And great name, by the way.
Thanks, Tyler.
Yeah, thanks for being here. I told a couple of people that I'm interviewing a founder of Body Swaps, and everyone was like, Body Swaps, that's a cool name. Like, what are they doing? We had so many options. But tell me more, what is Body Swaps? And maybe let's start with your background, right? Like, how did you get to do what you're doing anyway?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the name is a bit weird, and I have received quite a few weird texts and inquiries. And for some people, it means grave diggers. For some others, it's a type of movies. And then there's worse things I cannot mention right now. No, so in terms of the journey of the company, right? So maybe starting with a little personal anecdote. So when I was in business school in Paris, as you can hear from my accent, I did my first ever internship as a big consultancy firm, all suited up, hated every second of it. And at the end of the 6 months, I got this like interview, internship interview with my N+2, whom I had never met. And it was just reading notes. And he basically told me, well, we're going to offer you a position for when you graduate, but because you stutter, just don't expect to grow too fast. Is probably the worst things to say to someone who stutters. So after that, my confidence completely collapsed. I could not even pick up the phone to answer my mom, right? It was really, really bad. And then a year later, I registered for this like weekend seminar that I had to register to, not really looking at what it was. It was called Managing Crisis. And I arrive in this room on a Saturday morning, and I see like 12 chairs in a semicircle, and the teacher comes in with dreadlocks and like sneakers, which was very unlike my business school. And I'm like, what is happening here? And he goes, welcome to the improv theater class. And so I felt my like stomach go down. I was like, but I just could not escape it. I had no choice. Like, I had to stay. I didn't have the grades to escape. So, and then it kind of clicked, and I was like, well, either I go full on or I don't, right? Like, if you go halfway, it's going to be horrible. So I went full on, and I spent 2 days like pretending to speak in a gibberish language and falling in love and being a tree and all of those things. And I had a lot of fun, and it kind of rebuilt my confidence just like that. It was a very, very a powerful experience. But obviously, I was lucky enough to have that because I was in a business school and all this. Not everyone is going to get that. And then fast forward about 6-7 years, I've been in London for 5 years. I worked in social media consultancy, and I'm a little bit bored of the job after 5 years. And I meet this guy, Julien, in a pub after finding him on LinkedIn. And he comes to the pub with the Oculus DK1, which was kind of the first version of a VR headset when Facebook bought the company. So back in 2015. And so he had a big gaming laptop, two like tripods with sensors. And he showed me an experience of someone had recreated a painting called The Night Cafe by Vincent van Gogh. And they had recreated that painting in 3D. So you could walk inside the painting, but all the walls, everything had the brush of Van Gogh. And I found this completely mind-blowing. And I always was into storytelling. So I quit my job quite soon after, and I created an agency with Julien, a storytelling agency, which is a fancy word for a marketing agency. And we worked with Adidas and Samsung, with all the ups and downs of agencies where you go from project to project. And I had a friend who always told me, like, Chris, you need to build a product. This is not sustainable. And one day, as we were really struggling on the agency side of things, we received this brief from an education company who wanted to just try, so we landed 2018 by then, 2019, try VR for education, and they wanted to train nurses in psychiatry. And at the time, I was teaching at a business school in Geneva, storytelling for marketing with virtual reality and how different it is creating a VR experience for a brand than it is creating a TV ad or a social media post in terms of the agency of the people and the tools that you have as a creator. And there was one experience in particular by this British researcher called Mel Slater, where he worked with women who were severely depressed. He put those, I think, 17 or 18 women, each on their own in a VR experience, where they would inhabit an avatar that looked like themselves. So they would have a body. They would see themselves in front of a mirror, right, to take ownership of the virtual body. And then there would be a character of a little girl. So when I say a character, it's like PlayStation 2 level graphics, right? So there's just a character of a little girl in front of them in that space, and the little girl is crying. And what they told the patients is just say nice things to that little girl for a minute and a half, which they do. After the minute and a half, because the patients in reality have a mocap suit on them, what you use in movies, you know, to like do Planet of the Apes or Gollum or whatever. So the movements are captured and also the voice is captured as well. So what they did then is they swap perspective. So they put the patient in the body of the little girl. They go back in time 90 seconds. And because they recorded the movements and the voice, they're essentially watching their own avatar from the perspective of the little girl. And what happens then is they're essentially giving, they're receiving words of empathy from themselves, but as someone else. And that idea is fascinating. But what really was fascinating is that the results on, I think, 4 or 6 weeks, they did 3 times 8 minutes in that experience, which isn't like nothing. It's like 20 minutes in total, 25 minutes. But the decrease in the symptoms of depression was greater for that group than those who did CBT with a human beings. So when Sage, the education company, approached us to do training for nurses in psychiatry, the eureka moment was, let's flip that on its head and let's not make it about the patient, but let's make it about the practitioner. And so we created that experience where you would listen to a suicidal patient and then provide her feedback and then swap bodies, hence the name of the company, to listen to yourself from her perspective. You know, how do I sound when I'm trying to give feedback to someone or advice to someone who is suicidal? So that was the kind of the original moment. But back then we were still an agency doing a ton of weird stuff. And because the feedback was good, we started to look for like funding and we got a grant. And then from that point on, we kind of abandoned the agency. And on the first day of the first lockdown, so Feb 2020, that's when we wrote our first line of code for body swaps.
Oh, right. Wow. Well, first of all, I got a bit of goosebumps from the stories that you were sharing about like how you got to do it. But also, well, it feels like there is quite a bit of serendipity in that story overall. So that's super cool. But at the same time, I know a little bit of your story, and I know that from that first line of code, nothing was super easy, and you actually started with quite a bit of a bump. If you can share that, and you know, we often discuss founder dynamics and, you know, founder fit and all that here. So I think it will be quite interesting for a lot of people to learn how you overcome this.
Yeah. So back when we were an agency, before we wrote the first line of code. But as we did that prototype that I mentioned, we there was a third co-founder in the agency, and he is probably, creatively speaking, the smartest person I've ever worked with. Like his, you know, he could like take on a brief at 5 p.m., work through the night, and at 8 a.m. give you like 120 slides that would look perfect and be smart. Like he was absolutely brilliant individual, but a completely different way of working. And what happened one day, and I legally cannot talk too much about that, but what happened one day is when we were still an agency, we had a very big project, like large six figure, which for us, a tiny agency, was huge. And we massively mismanaged that in the sense that if you take an analogy, let's imagine we got a project to build a house, and this co-founder kind of say, guys, you know, leave it to me. I'll do it on my own. And he was a little bit like that. And he started by building the kitchen, and he built the most beautiful kitchen you can imagine. And he showed it to the client, and the client was like, oh, this is the most beautiful kitchen I could have dreamt of. Like, I can't wait for the rest of the house. And then he went, yeah, but I spent 40% of the budget of the house on the kitchen. And his strategy was to hope that the client would fall so much in love with the kitchen that he would just multiply the budget for the house by five. And obviously that didn't happen. So we went through 6 months of absolute hell. So we fired everyone but the founders. We gave back our offices. Then we were in a basement in a shadow of Whitechapel Hospital in East London without heating. Then we all worked from home. And then, you know, one of the founders like started kind of working on the sides, and we were fighting every day. And it was honestly absolutely horrible. And that's at the same time as when we got that brief, right? And I think if the agency had been doing well, if that project with that client had been going well, we would never have become what we became. I think there was a, because he was taking a risk, dropping the agency to do, build a startup. We're like, we're not startup people. Like that's not what we know how to do or want to do. But because the agency was going to die anyway, and we were literally talking with lawyers all day, every day, there was nothing to lose. So yeah, like it wasn't like a, you know, a well thought out plan 5 years before, like, you know, in business school or looking at strategy. It was really like an opportunity, and the bad condition made that opportunity all the more seductive. Yeah, because the alternative was not much.
Right. Okay. Well, I've heard quite a few stories here, like going from agency to the product, but that was, as you said, it was planned. It was kind of like thought after. So in your case, it was really like a boom, okay, it's this or nothing. So I guess in your case, the kind of the switch from agency life to product life has been probably even more dramatic. So if you could walk me through this a little bit, like how did you manage to move from one to another and to make this mental shift as well?
Yeah, so there was a meeting with the two co-founders during which I kind of said, well, this body swaps idea, which didn't even have his name then, was like, I believe in that. I believe there's a product. And I said, I'm going to do this as part of this structure or on my own, but I'm going to do this. And essentially one of the two co-founders says, I'm in. That's Julien, and still with me today. And the other one said, no. And so we went our separate ways. And from that moment on, I never had a fight with Julien ever again, even though we were fighting every day. So you just removed an element in a, you know, triangle relationship, and actually it works better. And so then we got a bit of funding from a UK grant, which was a kind of a one-time Innovate UK grant that was like 30% public money, 60% equity money from a pre-validated list of investors. It was a bit odd, but we knew personally one of the investors, so we got it to work. And then the first thing he said is, well, you need a CTO now if you're gonna build a product, because we were not the technical people. And he whispered the name of someone to be our CTO, and that guy serendipitously was the one contractor we worked the most with when we were an agency, because we didn't have any devs in house. We're like, oh yeah, we know the guy. He's fantastic. And then we approached him with a CTO role, and we offered some shares, and he was like, guys, you know, this is not enough. And again, it's the investors and a friend of mine who said, like, this guy is going to build and own your product, and that's what you want to give him? Are you stupid? Right? It's like this was just greedy. And so we realized, no, that is stupid. So again, a bit of serendipity there, because it was the right time for him, and also like listening to investors on, or at least friends on what matters. So that's kind of how it started. But then the new relationship with the three of us works very, very well. And because we're very different in our ways of working, but so we align on the expectations and where we want this to go, but we have different appetite for risk, different ways of working, different family situation, all of this. And I think that's keeps all of us in check. So it works well, but it's a delicate balance to find for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting what you said about hiring your CTO and like becoming your co-founder. I think, again, this is one of the topics, like hiring for very early stage startups and hiring senior people, it's always a bit of a challenge. So knowing what to give them and like what you're willing to offer is very important. But I also wanted to obviously ask you, yes, that first project kind of came for the agency and it became your first project for Body Swaps, the product. But after that, you started working with all the educational institutions. And well, from that little bit of information that I have on how they work and, you know, how the sales process is set up there, this is very long and you have to have the relationships and you kind of have to start the word of mouth working for you very fast if you want to work with them at all. So how did it work for you? Was it kind of this first project boosted the rest of the growth, or what other strategies did you try for Body Swaps?
So first it was a bit weird because the first line of code was written in lockdown, and obviously all colleges, all universities, everything was closed, right? So there was two things happening at the same time. On the one way, there was no way to deploy virtual reality anywhere because there was no heads to put the headsets on. But at the same time, the appetite for any form of digital learning exploded during COVID, right? They're like, well, you know, we need a world where we can do that. So it's kind of like the mid to long-term potential was much greater thanks to COVID, but the short-term potential was disastrous. But we were super lucky in the timing in the way that we had money and quiet times to February to kind of September, build the first version, so the first like three or four modules and get them to a decent level. And then what happened after is I think we had a couple of clients, but like really like direct contacts, people we reached out to and said, do you want to try it for free, that saw a post on LinkedIn, something like that. But the one thing that made the difference in our world, there's a gatekeeper called JISC. So JISC, the kind of a government organization that is responsible for bringing digital innovation to the edtech sector, or to the education sector rather. And what they said is, they said, give us a license to your product, and we're going to take it to five further education colleges in the UK. We're going to do the deployment ourselves. You do nothing. We want to be completely independent. We're going to write a report on that later. Right. And so they did. And because of how serious they are, and they really did not let us interfere in any way, when they wrote the report that said, this is a great product, and it's been used by five of the colleges, and here's the feedback, that really helped us. First, we converted all five into clients. Then we had a base to build from. And then we grew a lot through organic word of mouth, especially on social, because we had a product that was super social media friendly. You know, kids with headsets on is something that every educator wants to build. So that's kind of how we started.
Okay, that's very interesting. I would probably never think that social media is something that would get you into colleges. Well, unless you're the student, I guess. I would rather think, okay, it would be like educational affairs or some kind of events, or, you know, even, yeah, partnerships, maybe like grants and stuff like that. Did that ever work for you?
Well, so the value proposition evolves and the story to the market evolves. But imagine that you're selling a virtual reality simulation in which you're going to swap bodies with, you know, recruiters or patients, and you're in 2020. This is clearly an innovation product, right? You're not replacing an existing solution. There's no competitors really in the market. And so at this stage, if you look at the adoption curve of new technologies, there's no one beyond the innovators, right? There's no really early adopters or early majority. So that's your niche of people you're talking to, is, you know, 2% of the population in that market. And those people, their job and their passion really is to like find new things to play with and hopefully find value in, and then sell it into the organization. And even if you have, you know, 250 higher education institution in the UK, your target audience is like 500 people to start with, right? And so if you get one of those persons who tries Body Swaps and really champions it, this is such a small network that other people will hear from it. So in our case, at the beginning, organic growth worked very well because it was all about, you know, becoming on the radar of those people, lowering the barrier to entry for them. So the day that we started having a discovery package that was, you know, like 3K for 6 months unlimited, like it made it very easy. And then we understood quite early that we're not selling to those champion, we're selling with them to the organization. Right, so selling to them, the conversion rate was very high because we have a good product. But then the difficulty is we have 6 months or 1 year to help them convince enough faculty, enough senior leadership to get the, you know, reluctant IT people on board to essentially then take a license for one or more years. And so then the discourse is completely different. You're not talking about the magic of embodied VR and subconscious behavioral change and all that. You're really talking about, what's your curriculum? Who are your learners? How are you doing things today? How much is it costing you? Why is this better? Yeah. So.
Okay.
The superficial growth happens on social media. The real growth happens in customer success.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. That makes sense. What didn't work?
Paid.
Okay.
Like paid advertising didn't work. So we tried Google and just we targeted in such a niche that, you know, we had a lot of clicks and they were cheap, but the conversion into leads was nothing. We got some money from Meta, Facebook credits, $150,000 worth of Facebook credit. Same, very, very difficult. So for us, we are kind of like B2B higher education, quite niche. Paid didn't work. Events is very hit and miss. And it's kind of very hard to know beforehand what's going to work or not. But what we realize is sometimes the biggest events are the worst if the topic is not laser focused. So we went to a lot of like healthcare events, like digital healthcare, and you just have, you know, like you have a fitness solution in front of you, a mannequin. It didn't work. Whereas the few events that were super, super laser focused with only a few hundred people, that probably worked better. What else didn't work? That's all I can think of. Or PR, obviously, because unless you have, I mean, it worked at the beginning. We got some coverage on the BBC, and that was very helpful. But it's not something you can count on. I find systematically, and the spotlight has moved away from VR years ago now. So, and even when it comes to AI, we use a lot of AI in the product, but it's not cool enough to cut through the AI noise. Yeah. So really, what worked for us comparatively is leveraging individual stories of successful clients and moving away from talking about the product, talking about the success our clients had with the product.
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers. Yeah, that's amazing. That usually works. I mean, not only for you guys, but even for us. And we're not even a product, right? Okay, something else I wanted to ask you, because, well, you keep saying that it's a very niche market, and I understand that, yes, you must be right. But how big is it? Like, what's your total addressable market?
So it's funny because like investors have asked us to do that.
Exercise. So,
no. It's interesting. So right now, we really focus on the English speaking higher education market. So the way to look at that is just the number of institutions. So there's roughly 5,000 institutions in that market between UK, US, and Canada. And you have on very roughly, because it's hard to measure exactly, 5,000 students in those institutions. On paper, because our simulation cover anything from, you know, teamwork to job interview to communication, on paper, every single student could benefit from learning in BodySwap. So that's the side of the size of the market. Now, what's really interesting is we have a lot of opportunity to grow in terms of the number of clients, because we work with 300 institutions out of those 5,000. So that's good, even within the English-speaking market. But more importantly, the average size of a license for us is just under 200 users. And that's less than, you know, 5% of the addressable number of people we could talk to within those institutions. So I think that's where AI and that change of landscape is very interesting in two ways. Is really, it allows you to build flexibility into the product to hopefully really increase the ACV by saying this is not just relevant for, you know, year one careers now, but also for year two, or not for that faculty before that one as well. And also to target global markets is powerful as well, because the localization of content right now is, you know, a mix of any LLM and 11 labs for us for voices, you can go very fast. And investors are very excited about that. The truth is, it's all good to have a module in Polish, but what do you do when a Polish school calls you and they only speak Polish, right? Like you still need customer success, you still need to sell to the market. And then there's another thing on top of that, which is, for example, we have modules on communicating in a person-centered way in healthcare. So how to build a rapport with a patient to make them feel individualized and humanized. And in the UK, the version of this simulation is you have to look people in the eyes and you have to say hello when you enter the room, which seems, you know, quite like a logical thing to do. But a lot of people who work in those positions in social care and homes in the UK don't come originally from the UK. And in their culture, say Nigeria, for example, you show respect by only speaking when asked to speak and looking down, for example, right? I'm not 100% sure this is exact, but that's an example that people took. And so although on paper, AI makes things a lot easier, there's always the risk of you lowering the quality of what you're doing so much. Like, you know, you reducing your pipeline and your cost of creating the product by a factor of 10, but you're also reducing the quality. And this kind of like this tsunami of beige content that's about to hit us, I think is very dangerous. So we're really trying to find the line where you have to stay competitive but not devalue what you're doing. Otherwise, there's like an overarching lowering of quality in the market that just cheapens everything.
That's super interesting what you said. We just had an event last week where we started this conversation about AI. And you know, obviously we talk about acquisitions and how using AI could like potentially work on your valuation and affect it. And it just stirred this great conversation that was never ending, because, you know, basically everyone is still trying to figure out, you know, AI friend of foe kind of situation. Like, yeah, like you said, it can be so great in automating something, but then when it does it do a good job? Does it do a very mediocre job? Like, can you actually rely on it? So there is a lot of like uncertainty there. So I can totally back you up there. But in terms of, since you already mentioned competition, I guess you do have competitors. And as you just said, the market seems like there is still a lot to tackle for you guys, but it's not infinite. I would like to understand what is kind of the share of the market that your competitors have. And how do you stay competitive? Because, well, tech mode is non-existent anymore, right? Because of AI, because of, you know, the yeah, how fast everything moves. So how do you tackle that kind of challenge?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So one data point that we have is sometimes we do workshops, like physical workshops. So people from the sales team or the customer success team will take the train, go to a college in, you know, the Midlands, and do one day and put people in headsets. Our conversion rate on average from a deal open to a deal closed is 30%. Our conversion rate when we do a workshop like this is 80%. And that's all about because people love Janie, people love Laura. You know, it's so there's especially when you have a new product, the value of building a relationship and wanting to work with someone. And so I think because everything becomes AI'd and automated, the relatively speaking, the value of human connections increases, which is going to be an interesting one. On your question about the tech moat, it's a really good one because now for someone to create an LLM powered simulation of a conversation, well, everyone and their mom can do that. And for that LLM conversation to power avatars or videos, it's very easy. It's very, very easy. So that was the hardest thing to do. Like when we created a body swap, there was no AI. So you would do a monologue to an avatar and then swap and watch that monologue back. So what was the hardest bit is now the easiest bit. And that moves the value to other aspects. For example, like how well equipped are you to help with procurement when entering a new client? Do you have, you know, are you following accessibility standards, which takes a while to create? Do you have, you know, ISO 27001 certification for data privacy? What customer resources do you have? And, you know, do they make sense for your customers? Are they easy to access? So it's everything in that whole product model. There's little to no differentiation on the core product, and it's everything you built around it that actually makes the difference. So the community is the credibility, the resources. So that's our strategy. Another part, which is maybe more fundamental, is falling in love with your client and not your product. And what I mean by this is historically we were very much VR obsessed people with tech obsessed learning designers trying to build the best learning product there was for communication skills, right? And it was really this quest for being the very best. And I think we became that and people respect us for it. But everything we did was very, very focused on the end learner, the students, who is not our clients, right? Our client is the institution. And sometimes we build a module that's an hour long and then our VR champion would tell us, well, actually, we don't want students to spend more than 20 minutes in virtual reality. So your thing is too long. And so we really, most of our efforts this year, 90% of our effort has been on the platform for the educator, right? So who are the educators? What's their life like? Do they have any time? Do they care about VR and AI? How can we make their lives easier? And so you almost have to go to a point where it's very difficult, even internally, politically, to say, there is a trade-off between ease of use and sophistication of the product. And you have to somehow drag back the cursor to say, yes, this is a valuable feature to be able to customize this and that. But actually, it's even more valuable to make sure that people can get to an 8 out of 10 in 5 minutes rather than a 10 out of 10 in 2 hours. So that's, I think, was interesting. When everything is AI and automated, I mean, the attention span and the tolerance to friction is just so low right now that just people give up on a solution because there's one click too many, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
what we're trying to do.
That's a tough one to navigate, but it's great to kind of get a reminder that first, yeah, you kind of fall in love with building a great product, but then you start learning about the people who are using it. And it's only about people. I mean, we're in B2B and it tends to be like, oh, we're selling to companies. But not really. We're still selling to people. So it's really important to remember that. All right. I just have a couple more questions for you. And, first one is like, what's next? What are you excited about for 2025? Is it adding more AI? Is it falling more in love with your customer? Is it maybe exploring new markets apart from educational? What are you up to?
Yes, I think from a market perspective, so we opened an office in the US a year and a half ago, and the US has been working quite well in 2024, and it's kind of like doubling down on that market because obviously it's much bigger and it's exciting. It's also not a cheap market to enter, so there's a, you know, big price, but the cost of entering is higher. And then healthcare is a very interesting one for us. There's a, you know, global talent shortage in healthcare with an aging a population. We need more nurses. And I think this historically, healthcare education has always been around clinical stuff. And it should be, but not only. And a lot of that is, again, automated. And there's now a focus globally on the human side of healthcare, the communication skills. And I think we can really do something there. And we've started to see a lot of traction. So that is exciting. You know, how do you break bad news? How do you navigate a conversation with an angry patient? How do you make sure, like, the nurse who watched over you at night in the emergency room when they transfer you to the doctor in the morning is doing a right job and you're not going to die from a medical error? So all of those things. And then from a product perspective, it is using AI not only in the experience of the learner, as in, you know, like practicing with an AI and letting the educator define that practice, is using AI just outside of that. So you mentioned like the whole product model, right? How can AI be an assistance for you to help you design what the learner is going to see, you know, do it with an AI, and also help you understand how they're performing. So what's fantastic is if you're going to have an interaction in a simulation with an AI, let's say as a manager, I'm sure sometimes you have to give bad feedback to people. And if you practiced that with an AI, so, you know, if your trainer says, you know, we're going to simulate a conversation with a guy named Chris who did a terrible job. And if you simulate that, the level of data that we have about you is much greater than any other form of assessment and practice, but also your performance is much closer to that you would have in reality than you know, if you answered a personality quiz. So but that's just you. Imagine now you have 500 nursing students. What? How can the AI take all of that data and help you and say, well, you know, like Anna is struggling with active listening and maybe she needs an interaction alongside those 12 students, etc. So I don't think there's an answer between like friend or foe for AI, you know, to use your expression from earlier. I think we should probably be both excited and scared. But when it comes to education specifically, if we go beyond the whole like people are using AI to cheat on their homework, like if you just look like in the developing countries and the research that's coming now is like once trained for half an hour on how to use an LLM, kids with an AI tutor will learn faster than with a teacher. And when you think that you have 250 million kids who just will never see a teacher of their entire life, I think that it's the first time since I was born that I would bet money that in 10 years, the average level of literacy and math and is going to be higher than it is today. And I think that that's the role that AI is going to play. So I know this is not body swaps in 2025, but I think in this very scary world right now, very uncertain world, I think AI in education is probably a force for good. I'm pretty convinced of that.
Awesome. I need to create a reminder on my phone to check this podcast in 10 years and see what's going on. But, and God, I hope I'm not struggling with active listening. So it's literally my job.
Fair enough. No, you're very good.
But yeah, thank you so much. I think it's a great point. I feel like, you know, I'm trying AI with my son even, and it's super fascinating for him that, well, he doesn't need me to ask all the questions. Like when I see what he's been asking AI, and it's like a million of different questions. And obviously the one thing I like to do is check the answers. But apart from that, it's just, wow. It's such a great in to like the knowledge base of the humanity.
It is fantastic. And I don't have kids, but I can't help but feeling that it's, I don't know, when I was a kid, my parents, they knew everything, and they were the smartest people on the planet, and they were the source of truth. And that was it. Now AI is obviously better than any parents at answering pretty much any question that is factual, right? I don't know, like, do you feel the word is strong, but I do feel sometimes a form of like existential humiliation with AI, where it's like just making us feel less than, like, we created our own gods kind of thing.
I don't know. And I've never actually thought about it that way. I actually feel like we've created a great tool to potentially become better and to know something faster and to learn something else. And, you know, we literally have this access. And I mean, yeah, Google has been there forever, but it's just, you know, the working with prompts and actually being able to like ask like whatever I want in a form that's comfortable to me, it's been really cool. And like, I'm still fairly sure I'm still the source of truth for my son, but it's just like super cool. Like he can go and ask like how many stories are there in the Empire State Building, right? And I wouldn't know. Like, I don't know. I was there 12 years ago. I don't remember anymore. But you know, the factual knowledge is there. So it's, I don't know, for me, for now, let's say this, for now, it's a cool little tool and a lot of fun to play with. But let's see.
It's interesting. I think it's going to be a superpower for curious people, and for, you know, intellectually ambitious people. It's going to be, you know, people who want to learn, they're going to be able to learn so much stuff so much faster, right? It's amazing. But I'm also wondering, if you look at, you know, like 20, 30 years ago, when the internet came, it was like, oh, you know, the world's knowledge in everyone's pockets. Like, we're all going to become so much smarter, and we're going to stop voting for stupid people, and we're going to, and, you know,
well,
not to get political, but that didn't happen. And I think it is more debate on human nature than it is a debate on technology. So I don't know. Time will tell.
Right.
Hopefully, the
I think it's also, you know, it's also not just the access to technology or knowledge. It's just the way you use it as well, right? It's there for everybody, but somebody still votes for Trump. So, you know. Anyway, the last two questions, the usuals on the podcast. First one is, so far, you know, really cool journey. You're tapping into this amazing new technology. What has been the biggest win and the biggest failure?
The biggest win is, again, going back to people, the biggest win is always when you find the right person. And sometimes, like, so now we're 30-something, 34 people. And it's something as a founder, like the first few times when a deal is closed, because I'm more on this side of the business. First thing, when a deal is closed and you haven't heard of the deal before it's closed, it's like amazing. And so I think like hiring the right people was a win, and that's probably the most basic but best piece of advice I was given, is like the best use of your time as a founder is not pitching investors, is not pitching clients, is not like strategizing your product. It's just interviews. Even if 90% of those interviews, you're going to know after 2 minutes that this is not the right person, because they're all worth it for the 10th interview when it's going to be the right person. And then, you know, they take your business forward. And then fail. Well, there's too many to count, but I would say failure to extract oneself from the day to day, you know, like always, it's always prioritizing the urgent over the important being when you're a founder to really take a step back and almost shut off the outside world for just a few days. So you don't, not victim of that recency bias of, oh, we just had a client in that vertical, or like this just happened. And you can really take a cold, hard stare at your organizations, your numbers, your competitors. Cause I think there are some turns that we took retrospectively 6 to 9 months later than when we should have. And we had those signals. They were here in the data. They were here in the transcript of the call with clients. And we kind of ignored them because it's also the availability bias, right? You live in the echo chamber of your own champions. So you over-exaggerate, at least in the world we're in, we over-exaggerating how amazing our product was, because only people who love your product will tell you. Most likely when people don't like it, they just won't buy it, and you won't know. And it feels nice to just listen to a guy who gives you the compliments, right? So I think that was the fail. The fail was to not proactively listen to the things you don't want to hear.
Okay, that's a really good one. And hopefully, you know, it's not a failure. It's a learning. So now you know.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. If you hear it in time, it's a learning. Otherwise.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. All right. So the last question is always about a hack. And it can be anything. It can be, you know, something that helps you overcome the day-to-day, something that drives the product, something that keeps you involved with, you know, being on top of your customer's opinion, whatever works, whatever you can share.
The hack for me, it's almost a win a different way, is most of the company is remote. Like, you know, we have like 12 desks for over 20 people in the UK. So, you know, the product team will come one day, etc. And I think the hack was to pretty early on do twice a year an offsite team day that was unreasonably expensive for the size of the company, right? It's like, you know, it's offsite, renting a manor or a big farm, and everyone staying overnight. And I think this, having chatted about it, it's like the importance of those moments. And again, it goes back to people, the importance of those moments. It's impossible to measure or justify, but because you will never know that someone stayed for six more months, or someone worked that much harder and got you to close a deal or create that amazing feature. You will never be able to relate it to, you know, that moment when they had a shot at 3 a.m. But I think in terms of bringing people together in a world where people talk less and less to one another, and especially if they're remote, I think those moments are, again, relatively speaking, much more important than they used to. And so that would be a little hack. Everyone looks forward to a moment like this, especially people who just joined and maybe not at the top of the pyramid. It feels special. And also as a founder, almost as a mental health tip, you know, to not always be in your numbers, in your CRM, in your board meeting, and at some point to just be in a room, slightly tipsy, and watch everyone who works in your team having a good time, and telling yourself that you paid that with money from clients, and you just look at them and you're like, okay, well, I'm not doing this for a hypothetical price 5 years down the line. You're doing this for those moments where you just say, oh, you know, we are paying these people's salary. They're having a good time. They're having an interesting job, spending their weeks with us. So yeah, that would be my hack. It's not really a hack because it's actually expensive, but it's like, you know, spend money to have fun with your team at least once a year.
It is very expensive. We just came back from SaaS grouping, as we call it, our annual retreat this year in Marrakesh. And yes. I know, yeah, we brought 250 people there. And I know how much we spent on it. But man, worth every dollar, because like you said, first of all, it was just so great because we are also a very distributed team and we're 22 brands, you know, in every country you can imagine. So it was so amazing to bring everyone together to learn from each other, because yeah, everyone's in different stage and everyone's a different person. And it was so great. Like, it boosts collaboration, boosts just kind of the feeling of being this one company, one group, even though we're different businesses. So yeah, totally back you up.
Yeah, it's nice. It's you know, it's why we live also at the end of the world. Just build some memories, not just a bank account, right? So,
not about the money. All right. Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's been great talking to you. I mean, honestly, when my colleague pitched you guys to me for the podcast, I was like, yeah, I want to do this. Like, this should be very interesting. And yeah, you did not disappoint. So thanks so much for doing this. Happy to do it again sometime. And let's see what you're building in 2025.
Thanks, Anna. Cheers.
Cheers. Take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS, but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.